This is Thursday morning, May 2nd. We're in Pat Lucy's office, and this is an oral history project interview. My name is Martin Dowling, and we want to talk about the merger of the old WSU system with University of Wisconsin. I wanted to get some background, first of all, and maybe get your impressions, if you recall them at the time, or your impressions now of Wisconsin higher education in the 60s before merger. Or could we go as far back as Governor Kohler's attempt to merge in the late 50s and whether that had any effect on your...
Well, it did in this to this extent. I I was, you know, interested in state government then, even though I was a private citizen, and knew some of the people who were involved, both as regents and on the coordinating council that was created as a result of the failure of the Kohler effort, or it was sort of a compromise solution. My experience in talking to members of coordinating council was that they were left high and dry without adequate staff, certainly without an alumni association, without a faculty, without student body. They just were not in a position to in any way influence the central administration of either system. And so it was a rather futile effort at coordination, mm-hmm. in my judgment.
Even after, say, 1966, when it was refurbished kind of and refunded, there was no...
I couldn't see that there was. There was a Mr. Brown came in to see me, and he seemed, just in this one conversation, and I shouldn't, I suppose, make a judgment about him on that basis, but I just had a feeling he was very ineffectual and powerless, and comparing him with Fred Harvey Harrington and McPhee, who was running the other system, I could see where they would chew him up and spit him out in little pieces. Mm-hmm. And so it just, I felt that if the state was going to have any involvement at all, any kind of coordinated effort, that we'd better have something stronger than a coordinating council.
Did the failure of the first effort to merge have any effect on what you thought?
I thought the need, I watched that with some interest at the time, but mm-hmm. but I thought that the need for merger, or the rationale for merger, had become much more compelling in the interval between the Kohler III administrations and 1971. And in fact, of course, I outlined the details of merger in a press conference during the campaign. Mm-hmm. It was not something that I sprung on the general public or on the university after the fact. Right. Anybody who was following the campaign would have known as early as June of 1970 what I intended to do if elected.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to get to that in a few minutes, but did you have any impressions with respect to merger later on of Harrington's administration and his efforts to expand in Green Bay and Parkside?
Well, as a matter of fact, I had a small hand in that. I was mm-hmm. lieutenant governor when the issue was before the Senate, and I believe the record will show that I broke a tie vote in favor of putting Green Bay and Parkside into the University of Wisconsin system rather than the other system. And I did it, frankly, because I thought if this university was going to survive in the competition with the multi-campus system, that they'd better broaden their political base, plus the fact that I had a fondness for people in the southeastern corner of the state and in the Fox River Valley. And I thought we'd be giving them a better quality program if they were mm-hmm. part of the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a hand at all in his efforts to merge the extension system? Or?
No, I don't believe so. Yeah. I don't recall.
Yeah. But did you know Harrington personally in these years?
Yes, I knew him personally, and he used to come and see me even when he was working for the Ford Foundation over in India mm-hmm. after he had left the presidency. I thought that he was treated very shabbily by the regents, and it was a mistake to force him out the way they did.
Yeah.
He told me one time that if he had stayed, I never would have succeeded in my efforts at merger, and he's absolutely right. I think that he would have been more effective in opposing it, certainly, than John Weaver was, But more important than that, Fred Harrington was such a towering figure that I would have never been able to bring the Nine Canvas system on board. I mean, they would have been so in awe of Harrington that they would have resisted with much greater energy than they did.
What was his power also very prevalent in the legislature, or was it?
Well, I think it was
only in his own system.
I think he was a towering figure, not only physically, but and he had a certain dignity about him that I have, that you don't always see in people in high executive positions in education. I think that as far as the legislature was concerned, maybe he had begun to wear out his welcome a little bit. I think he was maybe a little too imperious for them, and I think too that the legislature, as we get more education into the legislature, they require a different type of handling than would have sufficed a few years ago. When I was in the legislature, the 1949 session, if the university condescended to have a banquet at Great Hall once during the legislative session and had us all there, we felt pretty good about the legislature. If old President Fred showed up at the executive mansion when some of the legislators were there, and his wife displayed her wonderful sense of humor, we went away feeling that, you know, we had really been stroked, and that we wanted to do things to help those nice people out at the other end of State Street. I think as time goes on, and you have not a lot of graduates of the county board, but rather graduates of institutions of higher learning in the legislature, and a lot of full-time legislators, that they take a much more sophisticated approach, and they're not easily conned, and they want to know what's going on. They're not willing, as some people used to argue years ago, that for higher education we should just put the money on a stump and walk away from it.
So the full-time legislator has more time to spend on investigating.
That's right. Education. That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think they do, and they're better educated than our group was. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have any impressions of the effect of the student rebellion period in the late 60s and Harrington's efforts to deal with it with respect to the need to change the system?
Not really. I don't. I was involved. I mean, when the Mass Center was bombed, it was during the 1970 campaign, and to the consternation of my liberal Democratic primary opponent, I immediately came out with a 7 or 9 or 11 point program to put down violence on the campuses. But I don't think that it ever entered my mind to relate that to the merger issue.
Mm-hmm. Who was your opponent then in the primary?
Don Peterson.
Okay. So at that point, there was no thoughts of. Well, I guess you probably answered the question that there was.
I didn't think it related to the merger issue at all. No.
Okay. What about the other side then? Were you in very close contact with Mr. McPhee?
Well, I had a great admiration for McPhee. I thought that he got the legislature to do things that they probably shouldn't have done, but I marveled at his skill in negotiating with them. And I remember one time, I think after I'd become governor, but before we had merger in place, there was need to build an Olympic swimming pool, I believe on the Madison campus. And in order to do that, in order to get the votes in the building commission to do that, we had to expand an existing swimming pool on one of the other campuses. I think they chose Oshkosh, and had to make that Olympic size in order to get the votes to build a needed Olympic size pool here. And that further increased my enthusiasm for merger, because it seemed to me that while Mr. McPhee was representing his clients very well, that was the kind of costly competition that the taxpayers could ill afford.
Do you think that competition was a function of these two powerful men, or was it a function of
It was a function of the system. I mean, and of course, merger One of the reasons that I argued for merger during that campaign was that McPhee and Harrington were both on the way out. Harrington was had been sort of nudged out, by, I guess that's even putting it mildly, by the Board of Regents, and McPhee was ready to retire. And it seemed to me that with the departure of those two men, it was a particularly timely opportunity to examine the restructuring of the university system, mm-hmm. or the two university systems.
Yeah. Were you involved at all with the work of the Kellett Commission?
I was not a member yeah. of the commission. I knew Bill Kellett from some years back. But
mm-hmm. Would that have had an effect on your decision to go for merger, that all the work that had been done there and sort of following Knowles, who was...
Well, I adopted a lot of the Knowles reforms. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think some historians might argue that I did a better job than he did of implementing his reforms. Now, that's not to take anything away from Warren Knowles. He initiated the reforms, had the research done, and had he continued, say, for an unprecedented fourth term, he probably would have followed through the same as I did. But I did provide continuity in carrying forward a lot of the reforms that he had recommended.
Well, I want to ask you then about the origins of your own ideas towards merger. There's a lot said about your consulting different people.
David Adamany was the key, and mm-hmm. if someone were to say, well, who is the father of the merged system here in Wisconsin, you'd have to say it's David Adamany.
Could you tell us about your relationship with him? Was it?
Well, I knew David in the 1957 campaign for Senate when I was chairman of the Proxmire Committee, and he was working the Green Bay end of that campaign. Mm-hmm. And I think at the time he was a teenager. And so we've worked in most campaigns that I've been involved in. David has also been involved. I'm trying to think of exceptions. I guess one was when I went down to Chicago to be the floor manager for the McCarthy campaign in '68, and he was all for Bobby, but he didn't care for McCarthy. But in most situations, David and I, without having a prior caucus, wind up on the same side of the issue and usually wind up supporting the same candidates. And he's a brilliant man and has shown his brilliance, I think, in terms of his rise in educational administration. But he argued strongly for merger and argued strongly for the timeliness of the reform, pointed out the ineffective solution that Kohler had to settle for by way of compromise. Mm-hmm. But also, I had watched the thing from a historic perspective for a long time, and I watched the one system grow from normal schools to state teachers' colleges, to state colleges, to state universities, and the change in nomenclature was not just that, it was not superficial, it did in fact reflect changes in the mission of that system. And of course it gradually became a system. I'm sure that the normal schools initially were pretty much freestanding. But as the two missions tended to merge, I felt that more and more there was just no justification for two separate boards of regents, two separate central administrations.
What do you mean by the two systems tending to
merge? Well, the nine campus system, and I realize it had some satellite two-year campuses, but the nine campus system in terms of four-year campuses started out simply teaching people how to teach. And gradually they developed liberal arts programs and areas of specialization, like at Stout, where they do a great deal in terms of sort of training middle management for industry and training people in food handling and hotel management, that sort of thing. But many, many young people who had no thought of getting a teacher's certificate wound up at Eau Claire or Stevens Point or Superior simply because they lived in that part of the state and felt they couldn't afford to come to Madison to go to school. So they were looking for a liberal arts degree that would perhaps propel them into a career in business or academia or one of the professions. And when they went out looking for a job or looking for admission to a graduate school, they were handicapped because it didn't say on that diploma University of Wisconsin. It said something about Eau Claire State University or something of that sort. And in many instances, in terms of undergraduate instruction, I think the quality of programs were probably, in some instances, probably as good as they would get in the other system, mm-hmm. particularly if you lump together the Madison, Milwaukee with Green Bay and Parkside.
Did you have to merge to solve that problem, though, to give them the name that they deserve to have? I mean, was there a real...
Well, I think there was more to it than that. As I pointed out, the unhealthy competition between the two systems, I think, was something the taxpayers could ill afford. I think that even having added the two campuses to the Madison system, or the University of Wisconsin system, the University of Wisconsin was at a decided political disadvantage in trying to compete for dollars with the more broadly based sort of junior system. Also, there was a tendency on the part of the people at Parkside and Green Bay to assume that because they were part of the Madison system, that they were going to become doctoral campuses. And with the surplus of PhDs that was beginning to become evident even in the early 70s, I felt that the hard-to-come-by tax dollars in Wisconsin could be spent for better purposes than creating two more doctoral programs. And the one way to eliminate that, I felt, was to bring about merger. And that was shown by a unanimous vote of the Board of Regents shortly after merger was in place, when they decided that they would have 11 university campuses and only two doctoral campuses. I don't think that the University of Wisconsin, with its four-campus system, could have adopted that policy.
Did you place much importance at the time on, I think that Adam Annie was one proponent of this argument, that undergraduate teaching had been declining in quality
here?
Here, yes.
I don't recall that that related too much to the merger issue. Adam Annie, then and now, stresses undergraduate instruction and felt that that it was getting short shrift on the Madison campus. But I don't recall that as a very compelling argument on the merger issue.
Did you consult much with Lee Dreyfus?
Yes. I don't know that I consulted much with him, but I must say I was delighted when he came forward as a supporter of merger. And he seems to recall conversations we had earlier on the subject, and it may very well be. I don't recall those conversations, but if he says they occurred, then I'd be inclined to believe that
yeah,
they did.
I think he seems to be the champion of this idea of equality of
instruction.
Instruction.
Uh-huh. Well, he'd know about that because he's had experience in both systems.
Does merger also fit in? There are comments in newspaper reports and in different publications about your sort of neo-political platform that year, or sort of a populism combined with the idea of keeping a hold on government bureaucracy. Does the merger fit into that as what as an idea as well coherently, or was it a separate issue?
Number one, I don't know what you mean by neo-political.
Well, that's just... I'd rather not use the term.
I think my...
Neoliberal, I'm sorry.
Neoliberal, yeah. I think I was sort of a fiscal conservative from the beginning. Some of my liberal friends seemed to be surprised when I began to be concerned about trying to maximize the productivity of each tax dollar, but they shouldn't have been. I came from the business community, and I hate to spend my own money, and I find spending other people's money even more painful, because I have a feeling of sort of a fiduciary relationship and think that ought to be super careful. Yes, I guess that I would say that merger did fit into that. I tried to be very careful not to exaggerate the economies that could be affected through merger. For one reason, I knew that they'd never be very conspicuous, because with inflation, everything goes up every biennium. And to say that we saved $3 or $4 million by eliminating one of our two central administrations and the staff of the coordinating council would be awfully hard to prove 2 or 4 years down the road. But that was a factor, and the factor of getting more direct fiscal control of the process by only having to lean on one system rather than two.
Fred Harrington made a comment in an interview that, from his perspective, your position on merger was also a function of sort of a general attitude in governors throughout the country, that education was an arena in which that the governorship could have a strong effect, and in that sense, that would be something that you would concentrate on in your term.
He may be right about that. I did not go to a pre-inaugural school for governors-elect. I didn't even attend the first governor's conference, which was held in San Juan, Puerto Rico in 71. So I really wasn't comparing very much with what my colleagues were doing at that point.
Did you have any contact with other efforts at creating a system with California or New York or?
Well, I'm sure that the people who did the research on it did. Yeah. I don't recall anything that I read at that time.
Okay. Well, I asked you about some of the people you consulted who were pro merger. Were there other people who had your ear who were attempting to dissuade you from that idea?
I don't think Joe Nussbaum tried to dissuade me, but Joe played a very major role in making sure that the merger worked. Mm-hmm. And I remember having the impression that as we went through the process, that it was a much more complex process than I had anticipated. I thought you could pass a bill and hocus pocus, next day you'd have merger. Well, it turned out that it was about a 2-year period of implementation.
Yeah.
And Joe played a major role in that. And Joe was marvelous in doing things like satisfying the regents. We even extended the term of some of the Republican appointees to the state university system, mm-hmm. Board of Regents, so that eventually the two boards would mesh, and that we would have two regents with their terms expiring each year, and not 9-year terms as the University of Wisconsin had, or 5-year terms as the state university system had, but 7-year terms for everybody, which with 14 regents worked out mathematically very well. It also ensured that while a one-term governor would ultimately appoint a majority of regents, it would take a 2-term governor to replace all the regents.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to come back then to the timing of your decision to. You had sort of had this pro-merger feeling for a while, but when it was a campaign issue, but it never really caught any fire. Is that correct? It was not.
Well, when you make a statement like that, a detailed statement in June of a campaign year, when you still have a primary opponent to get past, I guess it's understandable that you're not going to have people doing a thorough analysis of every word that you utter. I think it got fair play in the papers, but I think it was a one-day story.
Yeah.
It was offered as sort of a position paper at a press conference, and well attended. So it was not ignored.
Your mind was made up at that point then?
Oh yes, well I think everything that I spelled out during the campaign, I tried to implement.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe the one exception to that might have been, although I didn't quite commit myself fully on that, going to an annual rather than a biennial budget. And after discussing it during the interregnum, sort of, with Warren Knowles, he persuaded me that I was really asking for a lot of problems, and so we compromised by suggesting a biennial budget, but a budget review during the even-numbered years.
I want to know about in that election, the support that you got from faculty and other people at the Madison campus. There are different ideas about
during the election.
During the election and at the polls.
Well, Esther Kaplan was very helpful. We had a series of dinner parties at our personal home of faculty people, senior faculty, and Esther helped to organize those. Even supplied my wife with a recipe for brownies, which she still uses from time to time. Bri Curl wrote me a standard speech on higher education, which I used as appropriate occasions arose. Kitty Barbash worked in my campaign headquarters without compensation and tirelessly for months. There were a lot of younger faculty that were involved, some of whom later wound up in my administration. How the vote went on the west side of Madison, I don't recall.
Yeah.
I'm usually not a great vote getter in Dane County.
Mm-hmm. Well, the comments that I've heard about it are conflicting. One is that although you were supported on party line from a predominantly Democrat faculty, that it was sort of a lukewarm support and there was more support for your opponent in the primary. And the other is that the faculty was, in a sense, constrained later on by their support for you when you were pushing for merger.
How were they constrained?
They supported you in the election and they were opposed to this idea.
But if they were supporting me in the election, you'd think they would have read my my position papers. It should not have been a surprise to anyone active in my campaign
mm-hmm.
that I was going to attempt to merge the two systems. I do think, I think it's true that Don Peterson had a lot of support in the primary against me. He and I had both been in the Gene McCarthy campaign, but I was viewed, I think, as sort of a political wheeler dealer, while he was sort of a pure, anti-war liberal idealist.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost Dane County. I think I lost Dane and Green in the primary. Those are the only two counties I lost. And so I suppose, although certainly not a majority of the voters in Dane County teach at the university, I suppose that pattern followed through in the university areas of the city as well as throughout the county.
Was there strong WSU support for you in the campaign too? Were there people working for you from any of the?
I'm sure there was some. I don't remember. As far as the primary, certainly I don't recall that the Madison campus was for Peterson and the other system was for me. I don't think it was anything like that. Mm-hmm. In fact, with Peterson being from Eau Claire, I suppose that he did very well with the Eau Claire campus. And maybe since there tends to be some pretty effective leadership coming out of the Eau Claire campus, he may have done very well with the campuses throughout the other system.
Well, let's talk about 1971 then, I think. You were elected, and then, I guess first off, I'd like to sort of put the merger battle in perspective in terms of your all the things you were doing in your term there. Was that a major time-consuming effort, or was that a minor part of?
Well, I don't think it was. I'd answer negative on both. Mm-hmm. It was not major time-consuming, and it was not a minor consideration. Mm-hmm. It was one of the major thrusts of 71, but with good staff, a governor doesn't have to spend 16 hours a day on a project just because it has because one of your top priorities. Mm-hmm. I don't recall spending an awful lot of time on merger. I remember a couple of rather, not exactly heated, but rather dramatic meetings I had with John Weaver during that period, one out at the mansion in the evening. I don't know, that dissertation that you mentioned probably give as good a clue as any as to how much time I actually spent on it. But I was working on an awful lot of other things. I was trying to reform the tax system, especially the distribution of shared taxes. I was fighting for a budget that involved a tax increase. I was spending an awful lot of time with the legislature, and merger was one of the items on my agenda.
Could you talk about your staff who were working for you on merger? Who were the most important people there?
Well, during 71, Dick Weening was sort of my chief of staff, and he was very much involved in merger. And he was he's a tough guy, and was sort of a hard-bitten kind of administrative assistant, or executive secretary. And he worked very hard on that with the legislature. I mentioned Joe Nussbaum.
He was DOA, right?
He was head of DOA.
He was in charge of writing the bill?
Well, the budget shop is in his office, and as a matter of fact, we had so little cabinet government then that I was running the government, really, with a group of budget analysts with master's degrees, and most of them well under 30 and with very little practical experience in government, because we had these department heads who were responsible to a kind of faceless citizens committee and were not responsible to the governor. And so I used the budget shop to run the government, really. And the budget shop, the budget director reported to Joe Nussbaum.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple of people mentioned some of your appointees, Al Wild, Bob Dunn, Mr. Wood, as people who were involved with the merger.
Well, Bob Dunn was involved in everything, and Bob was not my number one staff person until Dick Weening left to work in the Lindsay campaign, which would have been probably early 72. I think Dick was only around for about a year, and then Bob Dunn took over. But Bob was, when he first came in, was sort of office manager. He handled all the personnel problems in the office, and did the hiring and firing pretty much, whereas Weening worked kind of on strategies and was sort of Mr. Outside.
Yeah, Well, I'd like to talk about John Weaver then and his appointment. There was kind of a fuss there for a while. His appointment was objectionable to you?
Well, I thought it was rather stupid on the part of the regents to finalize the selection of a president a week before an election when the outcome of the election was in doubt. Now, if they had known for sure that Jack Olson was going to be governor and that Jack Olson would be pleased with the selection, fine. But not knowing who was going to win the election, it seems to me they might have waited a week. Mm-hmm. Weaver came in as the choice of a Republican Board of Regents. I had the feeling that he came with a fair degree of partisan flavoring. And I think in terms of his dealing with me, he came in with at a considerable disadvantage.
The regents that I've talked to claim that you know, if it was a week later, they would have done the same thing, and that it was their decision to make and not a decision that they would consider the purely political ramifications of. Is that
it may very well be. Where from where I was sitting, it looked like a sort of political act of desperation on their part. Mm-hmm. And I found the timing at least suspect.
Was it that circumstance that had a strong effect on your later relationship with Weaver, or was it a personality?
Well, I don't know. I never had any real clash with Weaver. Mm-hmm. But I, I welcomed the fact that he wasn't very strong, because had he been a Fred Harvey Harrington, as I said earlier, I don't think I could have succeeded in the merger battle.
You had some awareness of the problem of a very conservative Board of Regents in the UW old system and in the other system as well. Was that a problem for you as far as who you were looking at as the major opponents of?
Well, I don't know. I thought I had a pretty good working relationship with both sets of regents. Mm-hmm. Once they realized that they were going to be not just shunted aside, I wasn't going to repeal and recreate and throw them out of office, but rather was going to fold them into this new system. And someone who got appointed to the state university system Board of Regents, I think in many cases felt that it was a step up to be suddenly elevated to a regent's post in the larger merged system, which made them regents of the University of Wisconsin.
Rost, in his dissertation, talks about Adamany as one of his reasons for merger is the very conservative board of WSU regents.
Merger didn't get rid of those people. We extended the tenure of some of them. That was not, I don't recall that being a consideration in terms of my decision.
Well, I'd like to talk about your tactics then in 1971. What was the reason for attaching the bill to the budget?
Because we had to have a budget. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed to me that I was dealing with the Republican Senate. And it wasn't going to be a matter of walking into two Democratic caucuses, one in the Senate, one in the Assembly, and persuading them to vote unanimously for this great reform that I was advocating. I had to find 17 votes in the Senate, And that meant I had to get a number of Republican votes. And my feeling was that the only way that I could get 17 Senate votes would be to tie it to the budget. Now, as it turned out, it was not part of the budget. It was a separate bill, and it was Ray Hinson's bill. Heinzen, how does he pronounce his name?
Heinzen.
Huh?
Heinzen,
Ray Heinzen. And he had introduced that bill, I think, at least in one previous session, maybe more. Mm-hmm. And I was delighted to share the honors with him and adopt his bill as my bill.
What could you explain that a little further? Why would it fly a little better if it was attached to the budget?
But you have to have a budget.
Yeah.
And so I just simply said, no merger, no budget.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And as a matter of fact, I'm sure the budget was delayed perhaps 60 days or more because of that condition that I imposed.
Mm-hmm. Was there an effort in April, May, and June to, I'd like you to explain sort of the balancing off of WSU interests with the Madison people, in terms of how the bills changed. It was rewritten, I believe, in April by Mr. Nussbaum.
I don't recall.
Yeah. There were more and more concessions as the year went on to WSU people, that number of members on the board were equalized between the two systems, and a number of safeguards for
then current members.
Right.
Yeah. I think Joe handled. Have you talked to Joe?
No spot.
Yeah.
No.
I think you should.
Yeah.
If you can.
Okay. Is he in town?
No. He's out west someplace. Yeah. He's somebody over at DOA would know. Mm-hmm. Paul Brown would know, I think. But he's head of Diller, or the equivalent of Diller, in some western state.
Well, you don't recall any sort of...
No, Joe was very clever at that sort of thing, and very thorough. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I sort of gave him my proxy and let him make what concessions he had to make to get a bill. But any concessions as to how many of the old system, of each of the old systems, would go on the Board of Regents... wasn't terribly important, because as their terms expired, they got replaced anyway. I remember in one case, after we had merger, I appointed Art, what's his name from up north? Let me just see if I can get it. Think that regions would be listed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll turn that thing off until I find it. When I appointed Art Bartleben,
okay.
I also appointed Mary Waters. And what I deliberately did there was to pick Art Bartleben, who had been a member of the Board of Regents, University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, and Mary Waters, who had been a member of the State University Board of Regents. And I picked Art in part because the Madison campus felt that they needed a strong voice on the new board. And right then, it didn't seem appropriate to appoint somebody from Dane County. So I go up to Price County and pick somebody who had been a very strong advocate of the Madison campus, and then balance that by putting Mary Waters on. And they were both former regents, one on each of the two earlier boards. And what was the point of that? No, I'm not sure.
I've forgotten myself. Well, now that you've mentioned Bartleben, who were the toughest anti-merger customers?
Oh, the Bartleben was very effective in his opposition, mm-hmm, to merger. And I'm sure he was taken by surprise when he got appointed to the new merged board.
Uh-huh. What was the nature of his effectiveness, do you recall?
Well, he wrote some very strong letters, and I'm sure did a considerable amount of lobbying with legislators that he knew, particularly legislators from his own end of the state.
Any of the other regents, Mr. Fish, was he a problem?
No, when de Bartolomé, I don't think, was actually a regent when he was doing his lobbying.
Right,
he'd been
yeah.
out of office. Odie Fish, I don't recall that Odie gave me any trouble. And this fellow from Platteville, what was his name? He was head of the board at one point.
Ziegler.
Huh?
Mr. Ziegler?
No, Ziegler is from Washington County. Cop. He came out and had lunch with me one day at the mansion, and we talked about merger. And I think both among faculty and among regions of that system, there was a certain ambivalence. I mean, it's true, Lee Dreyfus was the only chancellor who was out and out supportive of merger. But I think a lot of them saw their operation being upgraded a bit, or at least being made a bit more prestigious. And certainly I think that appealed to some of the regents of that system. Among student body, I recall having a lot of support from the Students Association of the state university system. But I think I had some support out here too.
Mm-hmm. What about in the legislature? Was there the Ross dissertation again? If I bring that up, it's he claims in there that that Republican leadership on the issue was lacking in the Senate, and that there wasn't a very unified opposition there.
Yeah, I think that's true, especially after it was Ray Heinzen's bill that we were trying to put through. At one point. You know, they invited me to come before the Senate and discuss merger, mm-hmm. and they went into a committee of the whole. And I remember asking Bobby Knowles how he thought I would respond to that, and he said he had told his caucus mates that he was opposed to their inviting me, but he said that. That he thought I would turn it to my advantage one way or another. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was to simply accept the invitation. And I went before them and read a prepared statement and then took questions for about an hour.
Mm-hmm. Was that July or later, do you remember? Or?
It was in the summer,
yeah,
I don't know.
Okay. Could you tell the story of the press conference, the joint press conference with Mr. Weaver? How was that arranged?
Gee, I'm sure you can find somebody that would recall that better than I. I guess if you hadn't mentioned it, I wouldn't have remembered it, but I do recall now that we did have a joint press conference. Mm-hmm. And I think there was some, after the fact, some misunderstanding as to just what he had said and what he hadn't
said.
Well,
it seemed the press sort of penned him then as
being pro-merger?
Yes, giving up his opposition. He made great efforts at the time and later to deny that, but it seemed to have some effect.
How did we talk him into that joint press conference?
I don't even recall. But do you recall when you were sure that it was going to pass? It only passed by one vote, and there were a couple of wavering Republicans that had like. I want you to talk about how their vote went, Mr. Cirilli and Mr. Not. The three Republicans that are named are Heinzen, Cirilli, and Krieger. And Heinzen was no surprise, but the other two, after talking to Odie Fish, he was kind of counting on them.
To go the other way?
To go the other way.
And, Odie was actively working against merger then?
Yeah.
I hadn't remembered that.
I wouldn't say that he was actively working against it at that late date, but he was doing a lot of head counting throughout
mm-hmm.
the year.
Mm-hmm. Cirilli and Dick Weening had a very unusual relationship. Have you talked to Dick at all?
No.
I don't know how you can put together this thing on merger without talking to Dick and Joe Nussbaum. Mm-hmm. How about Adam Annie?
I am going to talk to David, Mr. Adam Annie.
Are you going to fly out to Detroit or
no,
what?
No, he's actually going to be in the state.
When?
Next month in June.
Oh, really?
I haven't talked to him since early in the year, but mm-hmm. we have tentatively arranged a time.
Well, you ought to talk to Weening about Cirilli.
Mm-hmm. Is he in town as well?
No, he's in Milwaukee.
Okay.
You want a phone number?
Sure.
Try this one. Try 414-273-0873.
But there was a lot of press right around the time that the merger didn't pass on its own merit, that it was those two votes were changed for other reasons than just the pure issues. Is there any?
I don't know. I don't know. Tiny Kruger was an interesting fellow. Mm-hmm. He's an interesting fellow, and I would think he made the judgment solely on his view of the merits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was talk about his consulting with Lee Dreyfus very late, before the final votes.
That could be.
Okay. Did you feel then at the end of the, after it had passed, that you got the bill that you wanted? You lost a couple of things. I think there was you had a plan for campus councils, and as I was outlining earlier, there was sort of a shift as the year went on from
yeah. I never really, I really never felt terribly strongly about the campus councils. I figured that any chancellor worth his salt would set up something of that sort without having statutory direction.
Yeah.
What was the other thing?
And well, the sort of drift. This sort of concessions that occurred throughout the year toward the WSU campuses, their need to be guaranteed autonomy and clear mission statements in the law and equalization.
I don't recall having had any great problem with that.
Okay. Well, I think I'd like to move on then to talk about the post-merger budgets that affected the university. Most of my interviewing has been with people on the campus, administrators, Mr. Smith and Percy and others, and they claim that that first merger budget and the second one were periods of crisis management for the Madison campus in particular and for the system as a whole. Did you feel that there was fat to be cut out of the system?
Oh, sure,
yeah.
Sure. And in fact, Percy came to me with a report on how they had eliminated I don't know how many programs. Now, he made it clear that he wasn't talking about a lot of dollars because mm-hmm. many of these programs were simply on paper and had not been implemented yet. But if it hadn't been for merger, they would have become expensive. Percy took the position that whatever his past attitude had been on merger, that he was going to make it work, and I think he did try to do that.
Were you dealing more directly with Smith and Percy than with Weaver?
I had one very funny meeting. I think the only people in the room were Bob Dunn and myself, and John Weaver and Don Percy, and I hope that Don won't take offense at this, but I think it ought to be preserved for posterity because I was so amused when the two of them came in. It was obvious that the chief spokesman was going to be Don Percy, But at the outset, he was showing great deference to Dr. Weaver. Mm-hmm. And it was Dr. Weaver, please, Dr. Weaver this, Dr. Weaver that. And then after about the first 20 minutes, it was we. And it was all first person plural. And finally, in the last 15 or 20 minutes, why Don, as he warmed up to his subject, it became first person singular. And Weaver was sitting there almost as an innocent bystander. Mm-hmm. And Don has a very strong personality. I think that I don't fault him on that. I think that he, to accomplish the things he's accomplished, he needed that kind of personality. But I think that it sort of became unveiled as the conversation went on.
Do you recall when this was?
No, it was post-merger, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it was during one of the years when we were doing a preliminary on the budget. Mm-hmm. It could have been the 73 budget or the 75 budget.
Okay. Do you recall the asking the Board of Regents to prepare a report on, I think it was 1975, it ended up being called the Scope Report. I think Mr. Smith was its main author. It was designed to outline what the fat was that could be cut, and the statement that was made was that there was a triangle between access and cost and quality, and that cutting one came at the expense of the other two.
I recall it vaguely, yeah. But I'm sure you can get more. Mm-hmm. If you talk to somebody at the budget shop, you can get more
right.
Detail.
And do you any recollection of cutting the enrollment funding formula during those years when enrollments continued to? Was that a problem? It was predicted, I believe, that enrollments were going to level off, and that was one basis for stopping the growth.
Yes, I recall that, and I also recall that I used to find the whole business of the building commission a very painful experience, because here we were leveling off in terms of numbers, and numbers had been used to justify new construction. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we found all kinds of other reasons for putting up additional buildings at a time when it was quite apparent that the enrollment was going to level off. Mm-hmm. I thought that as time went on, we developed a rather good relationship between our budget shop and the and central administration. I think maybe the 75 and the 77 budget negotiations went much more smoothly than the 73 budget negotiations.
This is tape two of an interview with Patrick Lucy on May 2nd, 1985. With respect then again to the austerity budgets in 73 and 75, there were, was it your concern then with straightening out the budget, which affected this policy towards the university, or was it an extension of what you had planned to do?
No, the fact is that we had some periods where we had to be austere. I mean, you can't go back to the well every 2 years for a tax increase. Mm-hmm. And having gone in 71, I couldn't go back in 73 and 75. Now, what we did do to get additional dollars is, without an increase in the rate of a state-administered general tax, we would find one-time pickups that we could make, adding something to the sales tax or something of that sort. But it was a period that demanded austerity, and since half the state operations budget is the university, you couldn't allow the university to be immune from mm-hmm. the austerity that you had to practice with everybody else.
There were DOA reports and recommendations in those years that recommended the elimination of a number of campuses. Was that ever considered seriously as a...
Well, I had hoped that that the merger would make that sort of thing possible, but I guess the only campus that ever got eliminated was poor old Medford, eh?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I've always been a little ambivalent about that. You know, I'd say, well, it's too bad that Superior was ever built. They should have had a working arrangement with Duluth and had one campus for that urban area, but it is built. And here I am on the board of trustees of Beloit, struggling along with fewer than 1,000 students, and yet we consider all of these private sector campuses or institutions viable, except for the Milton that has already bit the dust, and most of them have enrollments of, except with the exception of Marquette, of 1,000 or so students. And if you think that they have a justification for being, it's pretty hard to say that Superior with 1,500 or 2,500 mm-hmm. or whatever it is, isn't justified, particularly when it's the only Wisconsin campus in that area of the state.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that if you were laying out a university system for Wisconsin with its present population distribution, that you would not have campuses along the interstate from the Twin Cities, three in a row at River Falls and Menominee and Eau Claire. But again, they're there. The physical plant is there. And Stout has been shrewd enough to develop a distinctly different mission, which I think continues to offer some justification for its continuance. And so when you get right down to cases, it's hard to say, well, which campus would you eliminate? Mm-hmm. I think in retrospect, perhaps we'd have been better off if we hadn't bothered with Parkside and Green Bay. But you can imagine the hue and cry that would result if you tried to eliminate either one of them.
But especially when you're in this system, it seems as though that within the system there's kind of a one institution, one vote psychology, and it's impossible to...
You mean in the old system?
I mean, no, in the new system.
Well, I don't know. In the old system, one of the things that bothered me about the Board of Regents, the state university system, was that each campus seemed to have its regent. And the relationship that existed very often between the campus executive and the local regent was one that ought not to exist. It put, if you had a strong regent, it put controls on the executive that ought not to be. If you had a weak regent, he became sort of a patsy for the university executive, and that vote was predetermined every time an issue came up that affected that campus.
Do you have anybody in mind here, any particular campuses in mind?
Oh, I hate to make enemies in the process of this interview, but Gene Murphy, who preceded Bill Girard as the regent from La Crosse in the state university system, and is Bill's uncle, is a very strong person. And I don't remember the names of the various campus executives that were in control of that campus during that period. The fact that I don't remember their names probably helps to make my point. When you had a question about the La Crosse campus, there was an inclination, I think, to call Gene Murphy, because he was the resident regent, and I don't suppose that he ever abused the privilege, but it was clear that that the campus executive, whatever his name was very deferential to mm-hmm. Gene Murphy. On the other hand, I appointed what's her name up in her husband's name is Paul, up in Wisconsin, or up in River Falls. Murray, her maiden name was Murray. George Field was the chancellor. At any rate, I had the feeling up there that George sort of had that region's vote in his pocket most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was after I had begun to make the appointments. But I can't think of her name now. But at any rate, and maybe it's not a fair assessment, but that was the impression I had, was that she tended to be dominated by George Field. And in fact, for a while, in order to avoid a continuance of that pattern, I had a rule, and you could only keep that rule in place for a time, is that I wouldn't appoint any regent from a town that had a campus,
mm-hmm.
in order to break out of that mold.
Did that affect the problem at all?
Oh, I think it helped a little,
mm-hmm.
yeah. But you couldn't do that indefinitely, because mm-hmm. after all, you'd be denying the system some talent for a rather weak reason.
Mm-hmm. One more question about your relationship with the administration. Could you compare the presidency of Weaver with that of Young?
Ed Young is a very good personal friend of mine, for whom I have great affection and respect. By the time Ed became president, he was sort of a interim president. Ed should have become president when John became president.
I've heard that before, may have been the cause of some tension between the two.
Well, I don't know. I think you're always going to have some difficulties between the chancellor of the Madison campus and the system president.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly it exists between Irv Shane and Bob O'Neill. But Ed was the logical person to have been selected as president at that time. But with the makeup of the Board of Regents, I don't know to what extent they even considered Ed. I think when Ed finally did become president, he was approaching retirement age and I think had a natural tendency not to rock the boat, whereas I think he'd have been a very forceful president 10 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any dissatisfaction with the way the system has worked in the last 15 years? Do you see?
Well, in the first place, I'm afraid that, I've been away a good deal. I was in Mexico mm-hmm. for 2.5 years. I've been traveling around the country and around the world, and as a private citizen, you don't sit in on the budget negotiations mm-hmm. or any of this stuff. I never intended that there would be a downward leveling of the Madison campus through merger. In fact, I didn't coin the phrase, but it has been used in another context to the point where it looks like I'm lifting it now from somebody else, but I kept referring to the Madison campus as the jewel in the crown. And I think probably in the last 10 years that the Madison campus has fared better because of merger than it would have fared if it had to depend largely upon the Dane County legislators to protect it from the competition of a widely dispersed competing system. I supported the catch-up issue that's being debated now, and I still find it hard to understand why the other system, or what used to be the other system, resists the 15, 12, and 10 formula. Because when one campus is competing with Harvard and Berkeley
mm-hmm.
for star professors, and the other campuses are competing with the likes of Northern Illinois and Mankato State, they ought to understand that there has to be a pay differential. plus the fact that the doctoral campuses do have a different responsibility to our state citizens than the campuses that are largely concerned with the instruction of undergraduates.
Do you feel that that differential would be even tighter without a merge system, or not?
I don't know. My feeling has been, now in this present context, I don't know. I know that some people think that merger is the villain of the piece. My feeling has been that merger has tended to help the Madison campus, because if they went in with their separate package to the legislature, I don't think they'd have the political clout that that the other system would have. Mm-hmm. And when you have to build two swimming pools instead of one to get one, it doesn't mean that you just generate more dollars. It means that you share the existing number of dollars in a less efficient way.
Yeah, but you can't see the, I seem to be able to see the same problem occurring now. People from Eau Claire demanding a swimming pool, you know, just
well, I suppose, but they system. But they don't have a separate central administration fighting their battles. Mm-hmm. And they don't have a McPhee, who was an extremely, I mean, McPhee would have been a good lobbyist no matter what. No matter what his mission was, no matter what, if he represented private business, he'd have been an effective lobbyist with the legislature. And I'm amused at what's going on now in the search and screen. I'm just sure that this search and screen committee will come up with someone from outside the state, someone who has great academic credentials, and someone who will be a babe in the woods when it comes to the other end of State Street. Mm-hmm. And here you have, as president of the system, a position that is largely administrative. You have a president without campus, without faculty, without alumni association, without students. He is the political spokesman for public higher education in Wisconsin. And I am amused at how they give such short shrift to a candidate like Dave Carley, for example, mm-hmm. Who would be a natural, and instead go out to make this prolonged search among academic types, only to come up with someone who will have to spend his first 2 years just getting acquainted with the cast of characters at the Capitol.
Yeah.
Whereas with a guy like Dave Carley, you'd start out with a fellow who on educational issues would have more clout with the Joint Finance Committee and the legislature than the governor would have.
I interviewed Odie Fish a couple of weeks ago, and he sees a real problem now with the Board of Regents and the system presidency being bypassed in the late legislature, just as CCHE once was by people from Oklahoma.
Going direct.
People yeah. from wherever, Milwaukee.
Well, I think Bob O'Neill's a fine fellow, but I think that maybe Bob should have been more forceful in making clear that he is, after all, the chief executive of the university system, and if there's going to be a pay plan, it will be his pay plan, but it will be supported, once it's adopted by the Board of Regents, it will be supported by the chancellors.
Mm-hmm. So you put a lot of weight to the fact that we have the wrong people in that position, would you?
I don't want to criticize Bob O'Neill. I think he's yeah. a fine fellow, and but I think he'll be a lot happier in Virginia than he has been here.
Where he's more
closely connected with the academics. Yeah. But I think here, the strength of the personality, the force of the personality of the president will determine how well the system works as a mm-hmm. system.
Can you see any danger in the fact that the right man for that job is not an academic, probably?
That the right well, I think you've got to have, you know, you don't bring somebody in off the street who's never been to college.
Yeah,
but I think they ought to be looking for a different type for that job than they would mm-hmm. for a campus executive.
Yeah. Would there be, would it be better to have another body appoint that, that position? It seems to me that they, that...
Well, the search and screen, no, the search and screen system, I don't think ought to be, ought to be eliminated. I was a little surprised that Dr. Lawton didn't put some regents on the search and screen committee. I believe, mm-hmm. I believe he had that option. We pick people as professors because they're smart, and maybe I'm underestimating their political smarts. Maybe they will show more of an understanding of the type of person they need than I realize.
Mm-hmm. Since the merger, and lately with this faculty pay problem, it seems that there is a tendency to sort of de facto demerge. There's a very powerful faculty union outside of the Madison campus that seems to have gained power ever since 1971. Do you see a disintegration of the merge system?
No. Any reform that you institute, you have to assume that, like everything human, that it has a certain life expectancy and doesn't usually go beyond that. But my guess is that merger is here to stay. It's pretty hard to unscramble eggs, and by the same token, it's pretty hard to unscramble the kind of system that we've created. As far as a strong faculty union, that union existed before merger.
Yeah.
Probably will continue to exist despite the very inept way that they're handling themselves in the mm-hmm. present controversy.
Do you see any way out of the exodus of faculty from the Madison campus that seems to be imminent?
I think you have to have a star system, and that's why I hope that we won't get into collective bargaining on the Madison campus, at least. The exodus, I believe, is real and should be cause for concern, but I think that our concern ought to be tempered a little bit by the fact that the promotion system of higher education very often requires movement of faculty from one campus to another. Mm-hmm. Many departments have the rule that they won't hire their own PhDs. They don't want to be incestuous about it. And I think that's, generally speaking, a pretty good rule. You can always bring them back after they become associate professors or something of that sort. Moving about, I think, is probably healthy for them, and it's really part of the promotion system. But if you see a drain of your stars at a campus, which is a world-class campus, obviously you have to be concerned. And one of the things that I have felt that has been a deterrent to industrial development in the state and a deterrent to keeping top faculty people is the sort of puritanical ethical code that we have in Wisconsin, imposed by newspapers like the Milwaukee Journal, the Cap Times, and even the State Journal to some extent, where they get terribly upset about outside earnings by faculty members. A few years ago, I went out to the campus, out to the hospital, to see Dr. Mack, who had operated on my wife for gallbladder. And he was embarrassed because the day before, the State Journal had listed his outside earnings in the paper. And I said, "Dr. Mack, if you hadn't made the list, I would have felt that I picked the wrong surgeon. And the fact that you are so in demand and make these outside earnings, that confirms my decision in picking you." And many faculty members who want to do consulting, like Charlie Cicchetti does, one of my associates here, many of them do their consulting outside of the Wisconsin area so that they'll be less conspicuous about it, won't be criticized. I think we've got to take a more generous attitude toward key faculty people who are in demand for consulting and that sort of thing, and allow them to earn some outside income so they're not totally dependent on what the taxpayers can afford to pay them. And I don't think you're going to keep, in some areas where consulting is a big thing, I don't think you're going to keep top faculty unless they have some freedom in that regard. And by the same token, if somebody has got a merchantable idea and he feels he has to take it to Dallas mm-hmm. or the West or East Coast because he doesn't want to be conspicuous sharing it with a private entrepreneur here in Madison, you can see what that does for our industrial development. And we haven't developed the cluster of high-tech industry around Madison or in a large loop around Madison-Milwaukee mm-hmm. that exists in the Triangle in North Carolina or in the Silicon Valley or in the Boston area where MIT and Harvard act as sort of the center of
the our attitude towards the faculty in that respect is important in that lack of development?
I think so. Yeah. I think it's a factor. I don't think it ought to be overstressed, but I think it's a factor both in faculty retention and industrial development.
I think that's about all I had to ask, if you have anything else to add.
No, I think we've got a bit of field of merger, but
yeah, that's all right.